Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the Senate quickly dispatched of the Mayorkas impeachment trial by not holding one. Another illustration of how the left uses the power it possesses in ways different than conservatives do or Republicans. Here was Mitch McConnell trying to make sure the record reflected that this sets a dangerous precedent that will no doubt at some point boomerang on Democrats if and when Republicans regain control of the Senate, much as the nuclear option that Harry Reid exercised back in the day, boomeranged on Democrats when Barack Obama wanted to seat Merrick Garland on the Supreme Court. Precedents do matter, and Republicans will sometimes use the power they actually possess. But I think there's a distinction that we'll get to in a second. First, Senate Minority Leader Cocaine Mitch and the China people.
Our colleagues know that we are obligated to take these proceedings seriously. This is what our oath prescribes. It's what the history and precedent require. And I would urge each of our colleagues to consider that this is what the framers actually envisioned. The power of impeachment is one of the most delicate balances our constitutional system strikes with a portion of the American people's sovereign electoral authority. It purchases a safeguard against malpractice, and it gives the Senate the power and the duty to decide. This process must not be abused. It must not be short-circuited. History will not judge this moment well. Therefore, I move to table the point of order and ask for the ayes and nays.
Is there a sufficient second?
Yeah, there is, and you got the yeas and nays, and it went down party line vote, and that ended the trial.
51-49.
Pagliacci Schumer saying to validate the gross abuse by the House by holding a trial would be a grave mistake and could set a dangerous precedent for the future. Great. Now you just cut and paste that, put that on the bulletin board in the House, in the Senate Republican locker room, and just bide your time until you're in a position to stick that cooked up rationale right back at down the throats of Democrats. That's how it's going to be. And yes, the checks on essentially the operation of the branches being checks on one another, the balance of power has been diminished. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. We'll cook up trials when we want to. We'll kill trials when we want to. That's what Democrats do. You know, the interesting thing about this, thinking about it, when they exercise power and when the left exercise power and when the right doesn't, my constant lament is that the left will exercise power it does not have, and the right oftentimes refuses to exercise power it does. So I think of another example. Joe Biden's unconstitutional socialization of student debt.
Right.
That's not a power he possesses, but he exercised it anyway. The power of the purse that House Republicans hold that they don't want to exercise when it comes to things like leveraging it for closing of the southern border. And there's so many instances of this. And it's why Democrats can move from staking out positions that are held only by a super minority of Americans but they dutifully pound and pound and pound away, intimidating Republicans in the process to not make those issues an issue until we wake up one morning and it's a plurality and then it's a majority of voters that have now adopted the position of the cultural Marxists. And when so, McConnell, when he's the Senate Majority Leader, he'll exercise power. He'll do the tit for tat, the mechanics of power. But because they're not philosophically oriented, and because they are very much politically oriented, as in their own survival or perceived survival, and status oriented in terms of their own standing, and institutional oriented as a cover for being status oriented, there is never this obstinance. Or rarely, I should say never. There's rarely obstinance from Republicans in a minority position. They're in control, so we're just supposed to sit here like potted plants and let them do what they want to do. And that sometimes happens when they're in the majority position, too. You sort of see it happening in the House right now. But in the minority position, more often than not, you'll see Republicans sit on their hands. Democrats in the minority position, they are the backbenching revolutionaries, hard charging, trying to block anything that Republicans want to do at every turn with everything at their disposal. Meanwhile, making the overarching character assassination that they use in lieu of arguments and advancing their flag, constantly pushing to advance that flag no matter how far back on the field they started.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
You know who else understands this, and I think would agree with that assessment, is Rand Paul. Mm-hmm. Rand Paul was on with Kudlow yesterday talking about a range of issues from this Mayorkas impeachment to FISA, which is coming back to the Senate, the FISA authorization without FBI having to get a warrant with respect to eavesdropping on Americans, to spending.
Yes, if the Senate Republicans had the guts, the stamina, the integrity, the wherewithal to stay together, 41 of us can stop anything in the Senate. In fact, 41 of us could have made them compromise on spending. But every time spending comes up, we capitulate. We're like, oh, no, they say it's going to be us shutting down the government, so we have to give the Democrats everything we want. No, we should say they're not doing their constitutional duty. So guess what? Nothing happens in the Senate. But see, already the next thing they have up after this is spying on Americans through FISA the way they spied on Trump. That comes up at the end of this week, and they're all freaking out. So instead of standing together and telling Schumer, you have to do the impeachment, they're all going to freak out and say, how quickly can we dispense of this? So some Republicans are secretly saying, let's get this done so we can do a whitewash on FISA and let them continue to have all the power in the world to spy on Americans. But I can tell you, I, for one, am not going to let them do this easily, and I am going to do everything I can to make sure there's a debate on FISA, because I don't think our intelligence agencies should be allowed to spy on Americans without a warrant.
Tom in Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Dan, I know often your inclination is not to operate the way the Democrats do. Today, Chuck Schumer will be hailed as a political genius, or he'll be honored for his ability to control the system. He reminded me yesterday, Dan, of Kathy Bates in the old movie Misery, when she put that chalk between James Caan's feet for coming out of the bedroom. This happens to Republicans every time, and it's going to keep happening because we don't fight fire with fire. President Trump was impeached twice, for a phone call to Zelensky and for the riot on January 6th. Mayorkas, even though it's not solely his responsibility, how many people have come into this country illegally? How many Americans have already been murdered by these people? and the Republicans get the little Democrat finger shook at them saying, oh, you silly little people, we don't have time for this. Let's get back to the work for the American people. And then they even have the nerve to say, had the Republicans passed Joe Biden's immigration plan, this wouldn't be happening. We keep getting our tails kicked because they fight dirty, and the Republicans are too cowardly to do anything about it.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Well, you know, it's interesting now that this precedent has been set, the precedent of the Trump impeachments, which in part precipitated the Mayorkas impeachment and the move on Biden to impeach him. I mean, that's still very much afoot. And so now you have a new precedent. Since nothing, you know, so much of this other than spending, that's a substantive thing that everyone agrees on for the most part. And it happens. The rest of this is just showmanship for fundraising emails and catering to your base and talking on cable news channels without any real implications. So now and by the way, to Tom's point. So when Trump was impeached, and those were specious impeachments, flimsy impeachments, no evidence-based. I mean, Republicans in control of the Senate went ahead and had the trials, didn't they? Right. Not in this case. Okay. So now the precedent was set is we impeach anybody for any important policy reason, or in the case of Democrats, we're just going to move to impeach every president of the United States. We'll come up with some, you know, thinly veiled reason to do so. The phone call with Zelensky, the non-incitement to riot on January 6th. And so now, so we'll set the precedent for impeachments all the time. And now we'll set the precedent for, but there's going to be no trials depending on who's in control of the Senate.
It's a quick 3 hours yesterday, Dan.
So it's just all theater. And then we do this and we talk about it for, you know, weeks and months on end. And it's sound and fury that signifies the further disintegration of the balance of power among the three branches, as I mentioned at the outset, as the Wall Street Journal, even though they were not a proponent, the Wall Street Journal editorial, even as they were not a proponent of the Mayorkas trial, suggested to go forward. Anyway, because there is a precedent being set, because there are implications. None of this means anything anymore. It's just to drive the news cycle in your direction by either focusing on the target you're targeting or defending the person you're defending. But it doesn't mean anything. Something as serious as impeachment, high crimes and misdemeanors. That doesn't mean anything to this republic. That's a sad commentary. And it's an indication of how unserious we become as a people.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. There was a protest of illegal immigrants, by illegal immigrants in New York City after City Hall was moving them to shelters not of their liking.
Oh, no. They had to move out of the fancy New York hotels. I don't know if they're fancy, but 3-star, 4-star, that's not bad.
Well, this precipitated a hearing before the city council, the noblemen and magistrates on the New York City Council.
This is unbelievable.
There's some challenges from people in this country illegally for New York City to live its values. Things could be better with respect to the shelter, the food, the language services.
But at the shelter, the food, my kids cannot eat the food at the shelter. And on Ramadan time, we couldn't eat because when you come back for the breaks, the food is no good at all.
And
they give us 2 months to stay at the shelter, and then you have to go out again with your luggages and the kids and find another place. It's very difficult. And also, I have a kid that is like 18 to 19. Until now, he doesn't have no school. So please help us.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. There was sort of different approaches taken at that city council hearing. One was the plea, like from that woman.
A mom, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The other was a little bit more aggressive, I'd say.
Okay,
this
what
was,
do you got?
This was a Congolese woman who offered a prepared statement in which she was speaking for many of the African immigrants in this country illegally at that hearing.
This is unacceptable. This is shameful time in New York history. This city is not friendly for all people. It is anti-African and xenophobic. Cette ville n'est pas du tout accueillante pour les Africains. Elle est raciste et xénophobe. Et on doit le dire. We came to share this testimony to let you all know in this council you all are responsible for this pain and suffering that will affect us for generations to come. But you also can change this for better. C'est l'hôpital qui se moque de la charité. New York City should at least live up to the standard it projects to the world instead of the mediocrity he has shown our community. Africans deserve dignity and respect. We are not animal. This country has a habit to... I'm so upset. You have a habit to receive all over immigrants, all over community. Why is it going to be done only to the African? Because it's an embedded protocol of racism and xenophobia in this city. And I want all my fellow Africans to know what it is that they will face if they come in New York City. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Corrine. Dr. Balde?
Yeah, we don't need to hear from Dr. Balde. We're good.
First of all, if you don't like it, if we're xenophobic and you're worried, you can always leave, and we would probably pay a plane ticket to take you back to where you came from.
Excuse me, we're not xenophobic, and we're not racist. New York City is. New York City, that's 80% Democrat. That's a sanctuary city.
I mean, they're already
that's
diverting,
not my problem.
Well, they're diverting critical resources from struggling Americans to help these people, and there's no gratitude there. They put them in a nice hotel with a free iPhone, three square meals a day, sorry if they're not up to your, you know, your food quality standards, then do something about it. Change your situation. They're just sucking off the tit of the government, and it's getting a little old. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I'm with a Congolese woman.
Really?
Totally, 100%.
Okay, why?
Who's she talking to? I just said it.
Yeah, she's talking to Democrats.
And Democrats created this environment where they said, yeah, sanctuary. Anybody wants to come, anytime, for any reason. And they elect politicians. Whose position is that? So why am I supposed to get upset when a woman challenges them to be who they said they were, be who they said they are? Why should I get upset with that? Why are we blaming them? Why are we blaming those African immigrants? I seriously want to know. Why? Why spend 1 second? Oh, you leave. You're living off the government. Living off the government? A sense of entitlement? Making claims of racism in order to get benefits at other people's expense? Gosh, where did they learn that from?
They assimilated quite quickly, is what you're saying?
Yeah. Are there any domestic parallels to that approach? It's almost like they've been emulating people they've been watching and listening to from afar. Well, I can do that, and I get to do that if I come to America.
And she had all the buzzwords prepared.
So how about a little bit of a mirror check as opposed to taking the cheap out? Oh, if you don't like it, leave. No. You've been invited. They were an invited guest. They are invited guests. New York City invited them. New York State invited them. Chicago invited them. Illinois invited them. I'm in no position to tell them to leave. I'm not the one who invited them. It's not my place. It's their place. And they invited them. And they're making the same claims with some of the same declarations that our domestic friends make. So why not? This is exactly what Thomas Sowell was talking about. If identitarians get everything they wanted, what would be happening? We'd be killing each other. Well, now we are. And now we're all going to fight according to our identitarian group. We're all going to wrestle with one another to see who gets financed by the government, who gets the most benefits. That's the game we have chosen to play. And now our Biden buddies who have been invited here, they want to play too. So what's wrong with that?
I just like a little bit of gratitude. I don't know.
Gratitude for what?
Like, hey, thank you for providing us with this, but the food that you're giving us isn't good.
And so what? Why should they express gratitude? Do Americans express gratitude for other Americans paying their freight? Why single out the African immigrants?
I was very grateful when I was unemployed and people were paying my unemployment check.
How about looking at this through the prism, rather than doing what they want you to do, which is jump on the ungrateful people who've entered this country illegally. Although, again, if it's an invitation, is it really illegal? If your federal government invites you and suspends the rule of law, even unconstitutionally, is it really illegal? How about thinking about this a little bit differently and asking some asymmetrical questions rather than falling into the trap that the left wants you to fall into so we can have this ridiculous binary about, Americans should be getting these welfare state benefits. How about nobody gets them? Oh, no, I don't. Can't do that. Oh, Americans are being shortchanged. What about the Americans who are shortchanging other Americans? Yeah, are we going to ever get to a standard, or are we just going to fall into their trap of playing identity politics? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Is this who you want to be? Is this you? What you think the path is? Because I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about the bad example. I mean, it's entertaining what you're about to hear from Jessica Jackson, who addressed Chicago City Council and 49th Ward Maria Haddon, 49th Ward Alderman Maria Haddon specifically, but just as an example. Miss Jackson, if you're nasty, she is very entertaining.
She's good.
And I like her, and people are too cheery. Oh, this is, we need more of this. But what's the message?
Well,
I mean, listen to the fracking message as opposed to just getting your rocks off because somebody is yelling at a politician.
So Christmas is coming early this year. We're going to check that list when you go up on that wall for voting, and we're going to check it twice.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to find out who's been naughty or nice based on how y'all vote. And we're going to start it off with Maria Haddon. Uh-oh. Yeah.
Chicago and some communities so angry. Why is all this kind of anti-immigrant sentiment coming up? And I want to explain to folks, it's because if we cared as much about black people and had over the decades as we do about everyone else, we wouldn't be here.
But the money from a 2020...
All right. That would be Maria Haddon. Stepping out there, y'all see you. Don't get sarcastic because we can get jiggy, right? You sit up here for that first $51 million talking about how you feel about black people and how you have to have the same energy for black people, and you ain't never stood on this floor talking about money for black people. You get on this floor and talk about black and brown because you're somewhere in the middle with it, right? But I'll tell you this, and I'm telling every other black alderman in here today, you vote for the money for these immigrants today, and we're coming for them seats. You can believe that. You're going to stop pimping the black people's plight to get brown people, as y'all call it, money. You're going to give us our press conference up there on the third floor, keep talking to the mayor's boy with the clink clink from his past. That's why he got to do what the mayor say do. Him and a lot of other ones in here with these shady past. That's why you got to vote the way that you vote. But all of us ain't got shady passes. Some of us free out here. And we can vote how we want to vote. And we're coming for those seats. Now, to align yourself with somebody who's obviously a one-term mayor, if he even makes it that far, you better be worrying about your job. You better be worrying about your longevity. Because we're going to vote, and we're going to get you out. Because you ain't doing right by us. That's what time it is. And for your law person that's next to you, I'm going to need you to check out that federal charge that I got against those public administrators over there for messing with black people's property. It's federal case number 23CV14590. All right? And on that note, if y'all don't give us our money for the black community, know this. We're getting ready to file a federal injunction against City Hall for benign neglect to the South Side and West Side. You got that? Boom.
Yeah. Boom goes the dud. Boom. Yeah. Right. So that's what you want to cheerlead? Let's argue about black people getting government money for this or for that versus brown people getting it for this or for that versus, what, I guess white people somewhere in the mix getting it for this or that. That's how you want to play it? That's what you think is productive? That's winning?
She's being celebrated on social media this morning. It's brilliant and wow. This, yeah, I know. That must see.
I know. Well, that's what social media does. Right. It cheerleads. There's a lot of cheerleading of ignorance on social media. I mean, it's the, you know, the hoi polloi, so you're going to get some good and you're going to get some bad. But but there are otherwise good people cheerleading this because they just want somebody to, you know, take it to the powers that be from any angle for any reason with any grievance and any proposed solution. So it's just, we're going to stick it to the migrants and give it to the black people.
Well, they also said we're going to, you know, see who voted what way and then get you out of office, too. She did say that.
Yeah, except, I mean, I've never heard that before. No, do I believe that? Do I believe Jessica Jackson and whatever posse she came with to do the oohs and ahs with her punchlines are going to take out members of the city council? No, I do not. Do I think there's some revolution going on in Chicago in the black community to stick it to the Democrat Party? No, I do not. Could they replace one identitarian alderman with another identitarian alderman representing a majority black ward? Sure, they could. And what changes? The name? Yeah, that's it. I mean, I just wish we could get people to think a little bit more deeply about this. It's just so easy to do the knee-jerk thing that Ms. Jackson does. And so, the criticism is legitimate. The solution is not. It gets us nowhere. And it's the same thing scapegoating immigrants who have been invited here. Forget the rule of law, because your federal government has. They've been invited. An open door is an invitation, isn't it? And they've been told they can stay, and they've been told they're going to get these benefits. And your fellow American citizens in metropolitan areas have seconded that motion. And you want to blame them for coming and saying, well, we can improve our situation by making our way, signing up on the app, getting a flight in. We got all these benefits. And what we see when Americans don't get what they want from their government, they call them racist and they say, you better give me that stuff that I want.
Yep.
So we're going to do it, too. And they're the ones to blame. Matt, Southside.
Not that it matters. But I like to ask that alderman who she endorsed for mayor. I'm sure she endorsed Brandon Johnson at the time, and now she's complaining.
Not an alderman, just a resident. But thanks for the call,
but
Matt.
But she played audio from a phone mail message left from her alderman.
Yeah, and then she wants to get jiggy. That's a bit of a dated reference, too, isn't it?
I don't even know what that means.
Get jiggy
with.
Is
that Will Smith song?
And it's also a sort of a lame reference, too. But, okay. I mean, I get it. She's ready to throw down politically. Well, good for her. I mean, she's doing more.
She attended the meeting. I mean, a lot of people don't even do that.
Yeah, I get it. But just because she attended the meeting doesn't mean you give her an unqualified attagirl because you have to actually listen to what she says and think about the implications of it. I know listening and thinking is not something Chicagoland is particularly adept at, which is why we're trying to promote it a little bit more. So maybe it becomes a little bit more fashionable. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, drag queen bingo, interest for the Downers Grove Library.
Oh, no. What now?
Spent the last couple of days talking about the Downers Grove Library Board after Bill Nienberg, who we had on the show yesterday, was removed from the board 2 years after he opposed drag queen bingo at the Downers Grove Library, as did many residents, because the majority Marxist board of trustees are identitarian goons and partisan hacks who wanted the drag queen bingo. It got canceled. And so they spent 2 years trumping up a rationale to strike back at Bill Nienberg, one of the few public dissenters in a position of governance. And they got him. And they'll get you, too. And that's the message. Mm-hmm. Grade 7 to 12 are invited by LaSalle County native Aurora Divine at Drag Queen Bingo for Teens.
Oh, that's the one that was going to perform at the Downers Grove Library.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Right.
That dude. Pretending to be a woman, scantily clad. I think she one of the events she was wearing a G-string. That was nice for the kids.
Yeah, the
so you got to tuck and roll, you know, type of situation there.
Right. This was the self-described raunchy drag queen who was going to perform in this celebratory event for National Coming Out Day. Mm-hmm. Well, this whole situation is, of course, beyond metastasization at this point. But in response to the CAST report that was issued in the UK that was critical of so-called gender-affirming therapy, in other words, the manipulation of the body chemistry and mutilation of children, that's what we're talking about. We have a situation going on in this country, and again, it's coming from the medical community as if they can't discredit themselves enough, although there is pushback here. But the Teddy Getz.
What's that?
What's that? Teddy Getz, they-them pronouns. Psychiatric resident at the University of Pennsylvania. He got his MD at Columbia. He studied gender studies at Yale. He earned his MS degree for developing the first animal model of gender-affirming hormone therapy. So now they're going to play Mr. Potato Head with the animal kingdom? Okay. Their lived experience... Oh, the pronouns they, them, I think I mentioned. Their lived experience as a non-binary, trans, queer, neurodivergent, chronically ill Jewish person informs their writing, research, and clinical work.
That's a lot there. Mm-hmm. Can you repeat that one more time?
Their lived experience as a non-binary / trans, queer, neurodivergent, chronically ill Jewish person informs their writing and research.
Okay.
And what is their writing and research? Well, it turns out that this person is, I guess, well-regarded in pediatric circles. He's the lead editor behind the American Pediatric Association's new textbook, Gender-Affirming Psychiatric Care. The new textbook is being pushed as the standard for treating trans children, despite the fact that 7,000-plus pediatricians have called for it to be removed. The book says you must affirm any child who says they're transgender, and the parents must be told that gender-affirming care is the only option. Why? Because a non-binary, trans, queer, neurodivergent, chronically ill Jewish person who's playing Dr. Mengele with the animal kingdom at the University of Pennsylvania said so. And then so fast forward to these events not being for just Downers Grove anymore, because if you listen, go back and listen to some of the clips we played yesterday, and I posted them online. If you listen to what that venomous shrew, Leslie Sadowski Fugit, had to say, and you listen to any of these leftist automatons about the gender-affirming business, it is always celebratory. And then there's this danger. If you don't be celebratory, if you're not celebratory, then they kill themselves.
Right.
None of that's true.
Yeah, but doctors repeated. Say it all the time. I mean, that's the pabulum that they use. You know, if you don't do this, you put the risk of your son or daughter committing suicide.
Some doctors say that. It's mostly political operators, including political operators masquerading as primarily medical professionals.
And we saw that during COVID. Mm-hmm. How'd that work out?
So, I mean, this is not just in school. Now you have to contemplate that if, you know, you have a child of an age such that you access a pediatrician. So that was why thousands of pediatricians across the country are balking at this, you know, officially sanctioned textbook that's being distributed as the, you know, the Bible for dealing with gender dysphoria, apparently. And now you understand, I guess, why it seems to be everywhere you turn. The only thing that's increasingly difficult for me to understand is why people are surprised. Give you an example. DeWitt, Michigan. Mm-hmm. I'll just span the globe here. DeWitt, Michigan, one Clinton County school is teaching an optional lesson that will share and explore pronouns with students in one of its elementary schools. The letter was sent home to Shavy Road Elementary parents informing of the upcoming teaching. Students would be listening to the book They, She, He, Me, Free to Be. Oh, God. And practicing using they, them pronouns. In addition, the lesson discusses what to do if students make a mistake with pronouns, imprison them, and learn that it's not okay to change someone's pronouns or purpose, imprison them. The book's content summary says it shows many gender presentations under each pronoun and invites even more. This begins in kindergarten and runs through fifth grade. One mom, Brandy Strahan, is a bit concerned.
5 years old to 7 years old, to me, that's, it blew me away. They don't need to learn, you know, about anything that's personal or sexualized or, you know, gender specific. At 5 years old, those are my babies, and that's my right and my husband's right.
Brandy Strand is concerned for her kids who attend DeWitt Elementary Schools. It says elementary school is just too young for a discussion on pronouns.
Yeah, by the way, yes, that's true what she said, but there is no proper age to promulgate the propaganda of these identitarians. Oh, if it's eighth grade, if it's high school, it's okay to say that this is the right and proper way to address somebody with gender dysphoria, just to cater to them and help them promote things that are not true. At what age is that okay? At what grade level should that be part of the curriculum? We sort of lose sight of the truth when we start talking about what is age appropriate. Yes, age appropriate in terms of topic areas, but there is no age appropriate for this business. I mean, you know,
just
people
go back
can
to
believe
the basics like writing, arithmetic. You know, I mean, why do we have to put this in?
Because we've chosen. It's like, why do we have to? Like, this is being forced upon us. Why do we have to do this?
When I get emails with the pronouns, it just drives me bonkers.
Why do we have to do this? Well, who's making us? Us?
I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
Yes. Public pressure. Societal norms. Oh, you have to do this. And then everybody starts doing it on their emails. He, she, them, their. It. There's a kid at a school in District 21 that they don't have. Their pronoun is dash. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
Getting a little cray cray out there.
Yeah. And then this kind of stuff happens. Out of Marlboro Township, New Jersey, mom and dad show up to the school board meeting to make a specific and detailed accusation about what happened to their 13-year-old daughter at the school, at the hands of a teacher these safe places. Why are they safe? Because we're identitarian apparatchiks. Because we are going to expose children to the wonderful world of gender identities and sexual exploration in the primary grades, and then just build upon that through the rest of high school. And we're going to turn a blind eye to predators in our midst, the same way the Catholic Church did. But we know we won't suffer the same consequences as the Catholic Church because, I don't know, I guess there's not, if this kind of stuff doesn't get so much coverage, nobody kicks up much dust about it. I guess there's a lot of, you know, people with the, why are they making us do this? Why are they doing this to our children kind of attitude? They're helpless. They don't have agency. Well, people in charge don't feel the same way about themselves, so they'll take advantage of that attitude. Here's mom of 13-year-old daughter who was allegedly sexually abused in school in Marlboro Township, New Jersey, addressing the school board. And her husband is there in tow.
Failed my daughter. You failed to establish mechanisms to prevent abuse, to prevent the atrocity that happened down that hallway to my 13-year-old daughter. My daughter was sexually abused in this school, in a hallway, on a camera, by your teacher, Jenna Shabika. You let this predator in our school. No denying, she's on video. A teacher who I've since learned through your peers, your employees, has a history of problems, sexualized conversations with children, bullying peers, intimidation, misconduct. Your teacher was moved from school to school for her actions. Your teacher, with the disciplinary actions, was kept in this district. She molested my daughter. The school failed to establish rudimentary training policies and mechanisms that are required teachings for the state to identify and protect against foreseeable harm to our students. Now it gets worse. Gets worse, right? My daughter, our daughter, after being sexually molested in your school, in your hallway, she then has to return to school and return to the accuser's classroom. So we could figure out how to deal with this public molestation. How about that? How about she had more torment in a classroom, in a building filled with adults? And she got more torment. Well, you figured it out. Sexually molested in that hallway, touched on video. The school failed to see the situation for my child. Then when the damage was done, the lawyer in this district writes me a letter. And I'm going to quote his line. If anybody should be aware of this teacher's proclivities, I hope you know the definition of that, it should have been Jane Doe's parents. He blamed me. For what happened down that hallway, your teacher, Jenna Shabika, molests my daughter in school, sends me a letter. The lawyer's in this room. He's in this room. And he said it was my fault.
You've got to direct your comments to the chair, please.
I got 3 minutes right here. Come over, Sal. I got six.
Go ahead.
Good. He sent me this letter. Come on. My husband has cancer. He's got chemo throat. I'll talk for him. Mm-hmm. He sent me this letter. I have a copy that it's my fault. My daughter was sexually abused at school. I said the quote by a teacher, you failed to protect my daughter from. I hope that you are not remembered for the ethical complaints in Florida. You know what you're going to be remembered for? For the guy who blamed sexual assault on a child in school by her to her parents. You blamed us. You can't make up this kind of stupid, can you, folks? You can't make it up. I ran to the fires in 9/11. I saved people like you. Who's running my fire? You are a disgrace. You can't even terminate Jenna Shabika. She resigned. 16-year pension. Publicly boasting about a change of career. Luxury. Right to resign. You sent this predator back into the world. At times, I don't even have the ability to comfort my daughter. She suffers day and night with depression, anxiety, uncontrollable fear. But that's because of some people in this room. The lawyer, that's our voice. In fact, you know what? This is the start. It is going to be my mission in New Jersey to let them know how dangerous this school is.
And we're happy to help Marlborough Township, New Jersey. Female teacher, female student, allegedly molested and apparently caught on video. Yeah. And enough that the superintendent said publicly she was removed from her position, but we find out from mom that she was allowed to, you know, quietly resign.
Yeah, so she keep her pension and not face any jail time, probably.
And to the extent that this was known, there's other questions about what reporting was done, because now the police are investigating the alleged incident. Now they are, because of what mom had to say at that school board meeting. And it all ties together, folks. It all ties together. But we're told anything short of full-throated celebration of mental illness, however it manifests itself, of identity politics for the purposes of acquiring political power to silence and generally antagonize, eliminate from the public square people of faith, and particularly Christians most specifically, conservatives politically, it all ties together. So just one wonders how many more examples must be presented before you start to think that maybe if I haven't had to experience this to this point, maybe rather than hoping to keep my head down and avoid it, I should try to get ahead of it with other people that have some common decency in and around my community. Because of what's happening in DeWitt, Michigan, that is, what happened in Marlborough Township, New Jersey, what happened in Downers Grove, what's happened in so many other schools and communities. I mean, it all comes from the top down, like a fish rotting. Here was Miguel Cardona. He's your Secretary of Education.
He's a real mimbo. I met him in person. Ooh.
The lead visionary for K-12 education in America.
It's like Matt Martin. This is
during a committee hearing, where he's, of course, requesting more cash from Congress, more of your cash from Congress. And Representative Andrew Clyde from Georgia has a simple question.
Can you define what a woman is?
I'll respond, Congressman Clyde, the way I did last year. I'm here to talk about the budget and how to support the students in your district.
Well, I think it's very important that you determine that you know how to define a woman. As Ms. Frankel mentioned over there, she wanted to be sure that women had their fair share of funding. If you can't define what a woman is, how in the world can you determine that they get their fair share of funding? If you cannot understand and clearly define what a woman is, how can you make rules that protect women's rights? You can't. So I would ask you to please respect this committee and the U.S. Congress by answering my question.
I respect your role. I respect this committee, and I said I'm here to talk about the budget, and if you have a question about the budget, I'd be happy to respond.
I'm mm-hmm. asking you a question.
And it just goes on for another 30 seconds like that. And that's the same attitude you'll get from your school board, from your superintendent, from your principals, from your local officials, from your state officials, from your federal officials, in many, many places. Not everywhere. Many, many places, including many, many places in Chicagoland. Won't you? Why are they doing this to us? Why are they making us do this? Is that what's happening? Courtney in Highland Park.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I want you to know that no one's making us do this, but when people won't stand up, it'll continue. I went to get a mammogram at the Midwest Center for Women's Healthcare. Let me tell you, by their website, they have offices in Algonquin, Arlington Heights, Buffalo Grove, Des Plaines, Elgin, Evanston, Glenview, Hoffman Estates, Park Ridge, Skokie, South Elgin, and Vernon Hills. You got all those? Mm-hmm. You guys, this is the Midwest Center for Women's Healthcare. I was then to get a mammogram, asked my pronouns, including they, them, which I'm sorry, no. And then I was asked if I was identified as male, female, female to male, transgender female, male to female. Mm-hmm. Wait, what? Let that sink in, guys. These are men. And gender nonconforming, neither exclusively male nor female. I normally wait 45 minutes an hour when there's just women. But I guess the, let me get that again, the Midwest Center for Women's Healthcare thinks that now it's okay, safe, and a good idea to give services, OBGYN and mammogram services to men. I just want you guys to know if nobody says anything, nothing's going to change.
Wow. Thanks for that, Courtney. Sorry you had to wait a little extra time.
Because I couldn't find it.
Well, I mean, because...
Well, you can't find the vajayjay because there's no...
Well, Dr. Teddy Goetz had the appointment ahead of her, and they were busy looking at his penis. So, trying to figure out how
But
to...
it's true. On intake forms now at hospitals, it doesn't matter whether you're getting a mammogram or other things that you don't even know about. They'll ask you, what is your preferred pronoun? I say, I just want the mammogram. Stop, you know, please, with this nonsense.
They won't stop with the nonsense. You got to make them stop.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, day off yesterday and the Trump trial. We got a look at one of the members of the jury pool that was not selected, but only because she had a scheduling conflict.
Right. That's the only reason why. And this might be another reason why Dan Proft is single, too. But
she was otherwise, I'm reading between the lines, but she was otherwise deemed to be someone who was able to be impartial. Mm-hmm. Here's what she said to the assembled press after going through the process of becoming a member of the Trump jury and then that not happening.
Can you share your opinion of the former president and why you felt that you could be unbiased?
I'm not a fan. During COVID-19, I lived with someone who was immunocompromised, and I think his handling of COVID-19 was abysmal. I have a sister who was adopted from China. And the comments he made about China when he was running for president made her very anxious and therefore made me angry. There are policies he has supported that regard women and reproductive health that I do not agree with. And I think all of that needs to be addressed.
So basically, he's a racist, misogynistic, almost killed her entire family. But I can be unbiased.
All the key phrase there, too, at the end is all that needs to be addressed. You know, like in a jury trial where we can punish him for disagreeing with our political views. Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, don't worry, young lady, because there are many behind you who I'm sure share your similar attitude. And as we've been saying, too, I mean, if you're going to put together a little star chamber proceeding and you're going to have a conflicted judge and a political hack pursuing his own political ambitions rather than a prosecutor operating under the rule of law, then you might as well wire up the jury, too. I mean, don't leave anything for chance, God's sakes.
She reminds me of that the juror, the lead juror, the foreperson in the Georgia Trump case. Remember that? His grand jury, and she went out and she was acting so weird about, you know, how she wanted to subpoena. She wants Trump to testify because she wants to meet him and see him in person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, before we get to our guests, I did want to mention this sort of short documentary film that was put together and is up at over at American Greatness and Greatness.com. It's just like 30 minutes.
Okay.
It's called Chasing Trump, and it provides a pretty good profiles on the four prosecutors, Jack Smith, Fonnie Willis, Letitia James, Alvin Bragg, and just, you know, sort of it's a nice little information piece that provides some institutional memory of all that's transpired over the last two and a half to three years now as well. So just to sort of refresh your recollection as we're getting into the meat of it, because there's a lot to revisit. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by Adam Mill. Adam is an attorney specializing in labor and employment and public administration law. He's a contributor to The Federalist, to the aforesaid American Greatness, and The Daily Caller. Adam, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dan and Amy, for having me on. Actually, this last article was published in ChroniclesMagazine.org, which I would compare to National Review without the Trump derangement syndrome.
Oh, right, yes.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, ChroniclesMagazine.org.
Yeah, Chronicles. That's many of our listeners will know Chronicles. That's a good description. Yeah, you've got a piece about Alvin Bragg's witch trial where you indeed compare it to the Salem witch trials. So, are we still? I mean, one of the things that you again refreshing our recollection because we discussed this when the indictment was handed down, but people need to be reminded. We're still waiting to find out what law Trump broke with the payment of said funds, aren't we?
So actually, we don't even know exactly what it is that he's accused of being covering up. Now, when you read these articles about the trial and what he's charged with, they almost never link to the original indictment. It's all just kind of this hand wave stuff, and they talk about all these, you know, they give the lists that you always hear about Trump and like the juror did about him being racist or about him having sex with a porn star. That's not what the indictment says. The indictment, and by the way, I'm not an attorney in New York. I just read the indictment, and I'm telling you what it says. The indictment says that he is accused of entering false business records, and there's like 34 business records, but they all the charges say the same thing. He entered false business records to cover up and further another crime. Okay,
right. So that's what we don't know.
Crime. And
right. We don't know what the other crime is.
Right.
And if you're Trump's attorney, you can win by either showing you didn't cover up or you didn't commit the crime that you're accused of covering up. But Bragg has gone all the way to the jury trial, and he's bringing the jurors on, you know, online, and he still has not identified the crime that Trump is accused of covering it up. And when he interviews it, he's like, well, I don't have to. And sometimes he talks about election expenditure disclosures, and other times he talks about committing fraud on the electorate. I don't even know what crime that's supposed to be. You know, at one point he says, oh, it's the actual agreement between him and Stormy Daniels that's illegal. But he doesn't know. It's a moving target. So that's, you know, that's why I said, well, it could be anything. You know, we'll find out at the end of the trial. Maybe it's witchcraft. You know, there's still a witchcraft charge on the books in New York. And as all of these people come, you know, tumbling out with their stories of woe about Trump, maybe one of them's going to accuse him of reading tarot cards illegally in the state of New York. And maybe that's what he was accused of covering up.
Well, this is so material because this is right ubiquitously referred to as the hush money trial. But paying somebody hush money is not a crime. yet the payments that were documented are in furtherance of some crime, said Alvin Bragg, who won't tell us what that crime is. And it's not obvious where he would be trying to hang his hat with respect to the underlying crime, because without that, you don't have much of a case, even, and maybe even with that, you don't have much of a case.
And let's just say, for the sake of argument, that the hush money agreement was a crime. Let's just for that, for this purpose of discussion, let's just agree in principle that maybe it was a crime. Trump hasn't been charged with that. He hasn't been convicted of that. There's no, how are they going to prove at the trial that he committed this underlying crime if they're not going to charge him and give him a chance to confront and cross-examine the witnesses about this, you know, this supposed crime that he's on notice of having committed? I mean, I don't know how they're going to prove this case if they're not going to charge him with the crime he's accused of covering up.
Well, at some point, isn't the expectation that he would? I mean, this is a kangaroo court to be sure, but even kangaroo courts have their limitations. I mean, isn't there the anticipation that at some point that's going to be charged, the underlying crime?
I mean, I don't see how they can do that. They can put a jury instruction asking the jurors to find that a crime was committed, but if he wasn't put on notice of the charge, I mean, if I were the attorney, I would immediately file a motion as soon as the jury is impaneled for the prosecutor to articulate what crime he's supposedly accused of covering up, and I would move to dismiss. This is ridiculous. I mean, I don't understand how you can put someone on trial for covering up a crime without saying what crime they covered up.
And the money that he used did not come from his campaign fund, right? Wasn't a check written to Michael Cohen? Like three separate checks?
Yeah, he used his own money. He reimbursed Cohen for these expenditures. And by the way, I don't know if you know this, he disclosed these payments to Cohen in a Federal Election Commission campaign expenditures disclosure. And by the way, all of these supposed false statements, I believe they all happened after the election. So I'm not sure how any of these business records could have had any impact on an election that happened before the false records were created. But we don't know, because Alvin Bragg won't explain any of this in his indictment. So I guess Trump will have to be surprised during the trial to find out.
You know, you got to be convicted to find out what you did.
Very Chicago-esque here.
It's just, I can't wait to find, you know, when I'm in jail, then I'm going to find out what I did wrong. It's something. Just on the assumption, again, here for the sake of argument, based on how fixed this thing seems to be, that he is convicted. I mean, doesn't he already have I think he's got several grounds to appeal, but it seems to me a glaring one right now would be the judge's failure to recuse himself, given at minimum the obvious appearance of a conflict.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the judges, if I understand the press reports accurately, the judge has a daughter who is actively involved in, political action against Trump himself. And, you know, there's definitely an appearance here that, the judge might be influenced by family members so involved with that. There have been a couple of updates in the case, if you don't mind me sharing that. Yesterday, the prosecution filed something called a Sandoval notice. And basically what this is the prosecutor is putting Trump on notice that if he takes the stand, here are the things he's going to get cross-examined on. So they're actually going to introduce to the jury the fact that, you know, this bond violations, you know, when Trump makes a public statement criticizing these cases, that's contempt. He's going to get fined for that. They're going to try and introduce that to the jury. They're going to try and bring up the Eugene Carroll case to the jury. Uh-huh. What does the Eugene Carroll case got to do with any of this? And so they're going to try and use Trump's criticism of the process as a way of persuading the jury that Trump can't be trusted. I don't even understand it. Trump subpoenaed communication between Stormy and some of these other Lawfare folks. So Trump's attorneys suspect that that Stormy and or her attorney have been coordinating with, like, Eugene Carroll and maybe some of the prosecutors. He's also subpoenaed the records of some of these former prosecutors that worked on the case to try and get a hold of records. But there's this story. I don't know if it's true, but it's a good story. That when they tried to serve Stormy, she refused to accept the subpoena, and they had to, like, put it at her feet. Oh. And now they're arguing that they don't have good service against Stormy. But so they're definitely trying to resist giving Trump documents that he could use to defend this case.
They can't show the Billy Bush Hollywood Access or Access Hollywood tape. That's not going to be played in court, correct?
I did not see that on the Sandoval notice, but I would be shocked if they didn't try that.
Yeah,
they can reference the content of it, but they're not going to be able to play the video. It. I mean, the whole point here is this is just like. It's all prejudicial, more grounds for appeal. It's all prejudicial. There's no probative value. This is just in case you have any sympathy or empathy for this guy or maybe even like him a little bit, here's all the reasons you shouldn't like him. This is just conviction by character assassination is what it is. It has nothing to do with the underlying law. And so this is, you know, a political argument to affect a legal outcome as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Did you happen to see that Trump's visit to Harlem? I think it happened yesterday.
Yeah. Right.
The video of it.
Yeah, I mean, the bodegas.
They may be surprised that Trump still has some sympathy. You know, New York is a heavily anti-Trump state, but it's like a 60-40, maybe a 70-30. So if you have 12 jurors, there very well could be somebody on there who remembers Trump from the old days and.
Yeah. The odds are a little bit more stacked against him in Manhattan, though. The other thing too, I mean, just in terms of calling interesting witnesses, if this is going to be, you know, the complete circus that it's setting up to be, how about Trump attorneys call Cy Vance and call the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District to have them testify as to why they passed on this very same case. How about calling Alvin Bragg to have him explain why he initially passed on it?
Yeah, I think you could probably bring people in from the Federal Elections Commission to explain why they passed on pursuing any kind of election charge against Trump. Yeah, I think there's a lot to work with, but they are hampered by the fact that they don't know what crime it is they're accused of covering.
Yeah, that's absurd.
And so they knock down. Right. If they knock down one argument, another one could spring up, in its place. It's really unfair.
Adam Mill is an attorney specializing in labor, employment, and public administration law. He's a contributor to The Federalist, to American Greatness, and The Daily Caller. His recent piece, Alvin Bragg's Witch Trial, you can find at Chronicles. And again, that documentary over, it's a 30-minute documentary on the four prosecutors, is over at American Greatness, amgreatness.com, called Chasing Trump. Adam Mill, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Good piece by our friend Joe Epstein over in the Wall Street Journal on BLM Brandon. Brandon Johnson is no Father Flanagan. The Chicago mayor, and it's not just the mayor, but focusing on him, seems to believe there's no such thing as a bad boy. That's the old rap of Father Flanagan, you know, Boys Town, Nebraska. There's no such thing as a bad boy. Is that right? There's no such thing as a bad boy. They're just a silly kid or just a young person who hasn't been given the right mentorship and the right opportunities.
Or it's just a young person whose brain hasn't formed yet, the frontal cortex, you know, which Judge Evans said.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. He writes Epstein, he would fight crime, meaning BLM branded, by providing more employment for young gang members, mentoring, programs to shore up the family in poor neighborhoods, and anything else that promises reform of criminal behavior. You know, and Epstein points out, well, that's a philosophy that's held by many residents. What do you see on television or from other elected officials or community activists. We need some programs out here.
Midnight basketball. Summer jobs where they can make minimum wage.
But Joe Epstein asks, what if there really are bad boys? And not a few bad girls. What if there are? Young men and women who consciously decide to deal drugs, carjack, join gangs, participate in smash-and-grab attacks in retail shops, engage in hit-and-runs with stolen cars, go in for drive-by shootings. What programs do we have for them? Well, the programs right now are no cash bail, no jail time.
They care more about the criminal than the victim.
Argument that Epstein makes is basically, look, the only government program I can come up with is pretrial detention, with the more serious the crime, the less the chance for bail and imprisonment for those convicted. Oh, boy. I mean, not exactly groundbreaking, but it is these days, I suppose. Pretrial detention, and the more serious the crime, the less chance for bail and the more chance for imprisonment and longer in terms of imprisonment. Right. Pretty straightforward, pretty simple. You get the majority of Chicagoans to agree, and then they'll turn around and vote for the opposite.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline. You can also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Well, I can help. I'm always trying to help. I've got a job for the kids, or jobs for the kids, that Brandon Johnson wants to get year-round employment. I know he prefers them on the government payroll, but they can be on the government payroll and still have a side hustle, really, you know, make the kind of money that could support living comfortably in Chicago, if not safely. Human smuggling. It's all the rage among the teenagers, as Newsweek is reporting. Two Dallas teens were arrested for smuggling, one of them a 17-year-old. They were offered $1,300 to transport. They're helping people get across the border into this country, and isn't that what we want in Chicago? So you'd be doing a community service, doing BLM Brandon and the Sanctuary City acolytes a solid, and you make decent money because the cartels pay pretty good.
And
you put the cartel money, you know, on top of the ever escalating minimum wage, and now you're talking about real money. 15-year-old male in El Paso taken into custody, charged with smuggling and evading arrest detention with the vehicle that was transporting five migrants.
That's about 5,000. It's real money.
Ted Cruz telling Newsweek, many of the gang members who are involved in human trafficking or drug trafficking are teenagers, of course. So, you know, why don't we just decriminalize it, pay for it, and kill a few birds with one stone? Same thing going on in Arizona. There's this Newsweek piece talking about juveniles smuggling juveniles, essentially, for cash. Talks about what's happening in Cochise County and other border counties in Arizona, where they're seeing a significant increase in prosecutions of juveniles for border-related crimes. As of November 2023, Cochise County Attorney, the attorney's office there, the prosecutor, prosecuted 33 juveniles for border-related crimes, 20 as adults, 13 as juveniles. That was back towards the end of last year. So it's something that's occurring. So, you know, why don't we take that example and just scale it here and stand up one of the pillars that BLM Brandon would like to stand up to make Chicago safer, but the Marxist way. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. A related story, there is this movement afoot, I don't know if it's a movement, initiative that one individual seems to be taking, and he's a neighbor of yours, to get a ballot question on the November ballot that would provide for recall of Chicago mayor you know, subsequent to the November election. That would be at earliest in March of 26. But the whole idea is a petition drive to get a recall provision that Chicago residents could access if they ever wanted to recall a mayor, which I doubt they ever would. But hey.
Hey, his name's Daniel Boland. If you're out there listening, please call us. But he's going to start this petition drive to collect 56,000 plus valid signatures by August 5th. So, and you know who's helping him is Governor Pat Quinn.
Yeah, of course, Gadfly.
You know how to do this, and because he helped with the referendum that passed against, you know, the governorship. Remember when Blago was governor and they wanted to get him out, so they changed the state law to oust the governor. But BJ, not really worried. Okay, it's just some dude, Dan.
It's some dude from the suburbs who's mad about the diversity and the formation in which we have put forward. You know, we've had mayors close schools. We have mayors who have shut down public housing. We have mayors who have woefully underfunded many of the public assets that we are working to establish and build. You know, so any individual that is somehow insulted, you know, by this progressive agenda that, quite frankly, is being led by one of the most diverse cabinets in the history of Chicago.
Dan Boland's racist. Mm-hmm.
That's a diverse cabinet. That's the important thing.
Right.
Yep. Who's ever upset about this?
He's racist.
Well, I guess. I don't know. This guy, based on what he told the Sun-Times, I mean, yeah. He's some retired network security guy. People can't even go out to the grocery store without getting mugged. People can't sell their tamales on the street without getting accosted by people who are armed. These are armed juvenile thugs. That's one reason that just put me over the top, he said. But then he said this. Really, the thing that motivated me more than anything else was when the mayor had a meeting scheduled with the Sun-Times editorial board and then canceled it because you wouldn't go off the record. I thought that just violated every principle of honor and integrity. I mean,
that's
yeah,
it.
Okay.
I could think of other things.
Yeah, I mean,
that's the hill you're going to die on. It was that issue. Oof.
I wouldn't hold out too much hope for this initiative, even with Pat Quinn involved. Somebody as competent as Pat Quinn, a tongue in cheek.
Well, they
firmly
tried this against Rahm Emanuel and Lori Lightfoot, and it went nowhere. So.
Joe, Southside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I was calling about the programs that you brought up, you know, the lack of. I used to work for Cook County Boot Camp. It was a military boot camp style program that they sent detainees through. And it was a good program. You know, we sent them through a GED program. We got them job placement. And unfortunately, it came under fire because they had sent some violent offenders through it. And now they put violent offenders on house arrest. So,
thanks for the call, Joe. Appreciate it. Yeah. Things have deteriorated is the message I'm getting from Joe, and I agree. You know, it's funny. I was thinking about this a bit yesterday when I heard that Slim Coleman, speaking of Marxists, Slim Coleman had died. Remember when Slim Coleman provided in his church in Humboldt Park provided a sanctuary for Elvira Arellano?
Oh yeah, that woman.
She was undocumented.
Yeah, was about to be deported, so she kept hiding. And I think it was overall it was about 12 different area churches. She'd move from place to place so she wouldn't get
So just think about that. That was in 2006.
Oh, that feels like 100 years ago.
So in 2006, the controversy was churches providing sanctuary for a single person in this country illegally who was going to be deported. Now the entire city is a sanctuary for people here illegally, and no one is getting deported. 18 years. 2006. Remember the city? That was a raging debate.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I remember I was a reporter, and I was going from place to place, like, well, if we do an interview, then she's got to go hide over here. And
now here we are in 2024. I mean, really think about that, because it's a wonderful illustration of how quickly and profoundly things go off the rails when you let them. Oh, it's just this concession, and it's just that concession, and it's just a political designation, and it's not the fight to have now, and it's not the fight to have then. One person here illegally taking refuge in churches with the No Borders crowd at the time, and now the No Borders crowd is in charge of the whole shooting match.
Thanks for
pretty quick turn, isn't it?
Yeah, I completely forgot about that.
God. Jeff, Northwest Side.
Hey, good morning. You know, there's no coming back from what this last establishment and Mayor Lightfoot have instituted. There's just no coming back when young criminals realize that there's no repercussion. They're just going to do what they want to do. I mean, it's so far, and you just use this term off the rails. It's I don't see it coming back.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to say how much further deterioration we'll see before there is even something that resembles a moment of hopefulness. I mean, a real one, not these phony ones that are just, I have great hope because I do and because, you know, we don't want to be forever pessimistic. I mean, something that occurs in terms of an election or some other exogenous event that says, okay, Chicago wants to try to salvage whatever's left. We're not, I mean, I don't see anything like that right now. But you never know. I mean, it's hard to predict these things. But certainly, if we're being honest with ourselves, which I know something is, we do not like to do that in Chicago, so I'm sorry for violating the protocol of just spewing beautiful lies if you have a microphone in front of you. Yeah, there's nothing like that now. There's nothing that suggests hopefulness for Chicago's short-term future. That's pretty clear. David Winnetka.
Hey, guys. Good morning. I humbly and respectfully disagree with you wholeheartedly about the timeline. All this insanity, in my eyes, has just came washing down on us like a tidal wave in the last 4 years, like a category cyclone, you know, whatever. And
came out of nowhere, did it? Nobody could see it coming.
Man, we all just sat there not doing anything about it, and that's why we're here. And now you've got, from me to everybody, it's our duty, our civic duty to our country, to who we are, to anything, to get out and start saying, no, this is so wrong, we're going to make it right, even if it takes us ourselves to make it right. It's just, it can't be done like this anymore. It's insane. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, I mean, I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that disposition, that attitude, but I don't see overwhelming evidence that there's going to be a lot of people running into panzer fire with you, David, from Winnetka. That's the issue. You heard how afraid Brandon Johnson is of, you know, the Mr. Smith goes to the fifth floor effort to get a recall provision on the ballot. Recall question on the ballot, recall provision into city code so that you could exercise it at some point. You can tell they're really afraid. George in Naperville.
Dan, you get rid of one mayor, you save the whole world.
Yeah, I wish it were that easy. Lee in Hammond.
Hey, guys. You know, I don't think there are any bad kids. I think they're right about that. There are no bad kids. What you've got here is a generation that's been taught that they need to put a chip on their shoulder because society has taught them that they can never get ahead in this society, is rigged against them, and that no matter because of what they are, they can never get ahead, and that if they have actually, if not the right, they have the duty to go out and strike back against that system. Because that's what they've been taught.
Right. They're
decades and decades.
Yeah, they're victims with claims, not Americans with opportunities. Yeah, I agree. Thanks for the call, Lee. Ralph Rantoul.
Hey, good morning. In the college where I teach, small, private, expensive, probably 40 to 45 grand a year without subsidies, I see a general degradation in behavior in the students, and really markedly among my young black students coming in. And I think they've been emboldened in bad behavior by all this BLM crap that they've kind of grown up around the last 3, 4, 5 years. And it's a real problem. I mean, I have problems this year that I never saw. And the administration, they're afraid to do things about it. They're afraid that they're going to get the race card played on them. I don't really care. I just care about students' behavior. And if you contribute in class and you're okay, then, then fine with me. But it's become a real issue this year. I've not seen it before, and
What's an example of what you haven't seen before?
A whole lot of talking back in class, a whole lot of getting up and slamming doors, and you expect me to turn in this work when, how, in what format? You expect me to actually behave in class and listen to. Participate with class activities, or stay off my computer. What, you can't tell me to close my computer. What, you can't tell me to put my phone down. It's unbelievable, and it's really disruptive to the point where I'm having to say, all right, look, just take the day off, get out of here, and take it up with the admin, with the administration. But they're afraid. When I bring things up to the admin, they're like, whoa, we got to be careful. What they're really afraid of, Dan, is low enrollment. That's what they're afraid of. They've got to keep the numbers up.
Yeah, they got to keep the cash flow. Ralph, do you want me to send Rocco and Moose over to your classroom to help Michael with his computer?
I manage it just fine. I'm more concerned about my cowardly administration backing me up.
There you go. Thanks for the call, Ralph. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The manifestations of climate change and the impact it's having on the world, thus the need for a sense of urgency, the likes of, Greta Thunberg. She seems to be about the most mature person on that side of the apocalypse. So just to give you a little smattering of what's happening, drive this point home, make it real. Climate change is hitting vulnerable Indonesian trans sex workers. Trans sex workers in Indonesia, 93% of those individuals saw decreased income during the rainy season.
You got to reinvent yourself.
Right. The extended rainy season is really, putting Indonesian trans workers behind the eight ball there. In Kenya, they're having to redistribute camels. If there was no climate change, we would not even bother to buy these camels, said the governor of a region in Kenya. The government there is redistributing camels to residents based on need, from those who have camels to those who need camels. They're in the midst of a drought there in Kenya. Is that new? Cows are dying because of the drought. But camels can survive the drought. So Kenya is buying camels from their northern neighbors in Somalia and giving them to people whose cows have died. And camels are better for the climate anyway because less methane.
Produce less gas, right?
Yes. Yeah. This is not the Babylon Bee. This is like actual.
I think I'm going to get me a pet camel.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to pour through here, and we need to provide these substantive examples of what's happening because we're on the clock. I know you thought we were like on a 2030 clock. No. Simon Steil, the executive secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, I'm sure you're familiar with it, said the next 2 years are essential in saving our planet. 2 years now. It was 2030. Now it's 2026. We still have a chance, he says, but basically it's a two-year clock. And maybe if a little more of our Western nations were a little bit more like Germany, things wouldn't be so bad. The politicians in Germany are the administrators in Germany, the bureaucrats, are trying to get the politicians to really put teeth into these symbolic pieces of legislation they passed. And so the transport minister in Germany is now threatening to ban weekend driving to meet the enforceable climate goals in their Climate Protection Act if the ruling coalition government doesn't pass the appropriate changes by the summer. Threatening to ban weekend driving in Germany.
Well, it could happen here.
It certainly could, at least in some states.
Or they could just say, you know, on the weekends, you're going to have to take public transportation. Metro, CTA, those are your only options.
And if you don't have easy access to public transportation, well,
so
then...
ride a bike.
No, we'll drop ship $200 billion in funny money to your state so you can build higher speed rail over the next 20 years. Sure. No, this is all coming together nicely, I think. For more on this and a few other matters, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Jim Pinkerton, contributing editor at the American Conservative. He's got a new book, The Secret of Directional Investing, Making Money Amidst the Red-Blue Rumble. We'll talk about that. That's available next month, but I'm sure you can pre-order it now at all the usual places. The Secret of Directional Investing. Jim Pinkerton, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You've written a lot on energy policy over the years, and that necessarily requires contemplating all of these dire pronouncements from the apocalyptic left. Give us your stop, look, and listen at where things are, particularly as we're reading a lot more recently about problem that America's grid is potentially having or is going to have in the not-too-distant future accommodating our country's energy needs.
Well, obviously, because the world needs energy, you know, energy consumption rises steadily, and as the Germans discovered, you can't run an industrial economy with windmills and solar. And so the Germans are kind of standing as sort of a bad example of what not to do. And I certainly admit it's possible, you know, we'll end up imitating them, which would be, you know, pretty calamitous. But I'm mindful of this. You can see the difference between states and countries that are succeeding with energy policy because they're drilling and going to nuclear, and those that are failing with windmills and so on. That helped me to think through the name of the book on directional investing that you were nice enough to mention. As in, folks, there are trends here to be watched, observed, and profited from. And so you cite some examples that I didn't think to put in the book, like the Indonesian sex workers and the
trans sex
camels. Those are trends. But there is, if you were an investor in, you know, camels, you could say, well, gosh, there's a bull market now in camels. And I'm not just trying to be funny. You can point to larger trends. And for example, I was just reading about real estate in Chicago and how an office building at 216 West Jackson Boulevard in the Loop just sold for $2.6 million. That was a decline from $22 million. Just 11 years ago, a 90% cut. And, you know, that is a clear trend. It's obviously a negative bearish trend on Chicago. And so then one can contemplate as a trend watcher, you know, what are the prospects for Chicago real estate going forward?
How is the Democratic convention going to go? What are Mayor Johnson's reelection prospects? And that'll tell you a lot about the future direction of real estate. And that's an investment play. And again, we can talk about it from a political point of view, but we can also say there's money to be made here, including not just watching a stock or real estate asset or a value go up, but also if it goes down, you can short all these assets, including real estate investment trusts, and make money that way. So it's, the main point is just to, you know, watch the trends closely and draw conclusions about where investments are headed.
Oh, and it's well, not only Chicago. I mean, did you see that skyscraper in St. Louis that sold for $205 million? It just sold for $3.5 million a few years later.
Well, I mean, again, that, there's a trend there. Not only is it the trouble of crime and downtowns and so on, but also just the work-from-home trend, which, you know, makes for, you know, if you see people working from home, then that's a good bet. Just as an investor, you could say, well, that's good news for bicycles and good news for the local Starbucks, good news for, you know, Wi-Fi providers and, you know, VPN makers and so on. So, again, a lot is a homage to Peter Lynch, who, you know, baby boomers will remember, was a big investor in the 80s and 90s and wrote a series of books with titles like, you know, One Up on Wall Street. And he just made the emphasis on observe what people are doing, and if it seems like that's something they like to do, it's probably a good investment.
So, I mean, what is that? So what are trends that you see that may be below the fold? You know, the obvious ones are the you know, the Magnificent Seven, social media and tech stocks, and and you know, the commercial, you know, the coming crash in commercial real estate, it was, has been long predicted. I mean, are there other trends? What about industrial policy? You know, the rent seekers. So one trend is we're just printing and spending all kinds of money on solar and wind and other green energy projects. So, but if so, you would say it would take a long position on those, but if they don't really have the prospect of bearing much return other than government propping them up, then maybe not so much.
Well, that's exactly the calculation to make. I mean, Mark Mills at the Manhattan Institute calculated recently that we spent more money on green energy adjusted for inflation than we did in World War II. And so there's a reason why Al Gore is so fat and happy. Because, you know, all the government has allocated $5 trillion to help his investments and so on. So, of course, he's rich. And so if you can calculate, again, this is thinking about this in terms of just investment portfolio. If you think the green energy subsidies will continue forever, then they're probably a good investment. You may not approve of that politically, but investment-wise, you know, the trend is your friend. Now, it's also possible that there's been a, you know, sort of a crack up on green energy. You know, Tesla stock is way down. You know, the popularity of electric vehicles is way down. It's also possible that these huge subsidies to green energy will stop, in which case you need to get out of those investments. And another trend along the same lines is just the split between red blue. And you know, anybody who invested in Disney is sad because the stock is down 40% in the last 3 years. You can make the same point about, you know, AB and Bud Light and, you know, Planet Fitness and other companies. And so you can see that. And also, I would say BlackRock. You know, BlackRock has taken a huge hit on wokeness and DEI. And so I would say not only is BlackRock probably a stock or an asset to stay away from, but inevitably, if BlackRock becomes Blue Rock is just kind of a Democratic operation, there will be a Red Rock. You've already seen, you know, Ken Griffin left Chicago to go to Florida. You know, you can see a new kind of Wall Street emerging in Florida or perhaps Texas, you know, states with zero income tax. And so, which is just the main point is to observe, you know, look, Illinois is sort of doubling down on, you know, transgenderism. And if you think that's a good investment, you know, in terms of hospitals and medical treatment and so on, then get into that. It might not be as good as camels and sex workers, but it could be something.
Well, what about making a bet on somebody who's engaged in a in a turnaround attempt like Milei in Argentina?
Well, that's a good example. I mean, he's an amazing, interesting figure. And yeah, if you read the news and follow it, you can invest in the real and a million other ways to invest in Argentina. And conversely, you can see what's going on in Brazil, the next country over. You know, if they eliminate Twitter and X, you know, Twitter itself is not that big a deal for an economy, but the signal sent to investors is not unlike what's happened to China. You know, the Chinese communists started cracking down on tech, and all of a sudden, you know, the stock market in China has plummeted. You know, I mean, the U.S. stock market is now, you know, worth 10 times what it is in China, just for all the economic energy and employment and manufacturing of China. Investors are afraid that you're going to get another Mao Zedong there sooner or later, and that makes them terrified and makes it a terrible place to invest.
So I saw in your book that you've got some blurbs from some impressive people like Joe Lonsdale, who's a founder of Palantir. Maybe you did that with Palantir and you were ahead of a learning curve, but have you done this yourself in terms of this is the way that you think about where you make bets? And is there any example? If so, is there an example you could share?
A great example is Exxon. Exxon has been a great stock. Mm. You know, in the middle of all this green energy stuff, Exxon has just kept drilling and drilling and drilling. And they've invested some money in green projects, and they've also invested a lot in carbon capture, which I think is sort of a sleeper issue. I was just at a conference yesterday here in Washington, and Zaid Ali, the head of the green energy thing at the office at the White House, at the Biden White House, was saying, they asked him, what's the big sort of moonshot for climate change to come? And he said carbon capture. And so, you know, there's a lot of companies, including Lanza Tech in Skokie, that is very involved in using microbes to capture carbon. Again, we can have an argument about whether climate change is real and so on and so on. But if governments around the world, you know, from Illinois to the United States to the United Nations are spending trillions on climate change, then some smart person is going to say, listen, it's a lot easier to, if you're worried about CO2 in the atmosphere, just take it out. Plant a tree, use microbes, use direct air capture, something. All those technologies are booming because the investors look ahead and see there's enormous demand for them.
He is Jim Pinkerton, contributing editor at the American Conservative. His new book, The Secret of Directional Investing, Making Money Amidst the Red Blue Rumble. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Good luck with the book.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I want to get our next guest comment on this, but a report in the Times of Israel was that in exchange for not carrying out a large strike on Iran, the U.S. has agreed to Israel's plan for rooting out more Hamas terrorists in Rafah. Now, I'm not so sure that Joe Biden is aware of this report or is aware of this agreement or is aware of Rafah, because it didn't seem like he was yesterday when he addressed the topic.
And I made it clear to Israelis, don't move on Haifa. It's just not, I mean, anyway, I just, look what we did recently when Israel was attacked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rafah, that's in Israel.
Thank goodness for, speaking of Israel, along with help from the United States and Jordan and apparently Saudi Arabia, being able to defend themselves from that attack was no thanks to Joe Biden. The Wall Street Journal reminds us, dutifully, that Joe Biden scoffed at missile defense systems when they were proposed by one President Ronald Reagan back in the 80s. In fact, Joe Biden said, you know, that it was derisively termed Star Wars by Ted Kennedy, actually. Joe Biden in a National Press Club speech. Star Wars represents a fundamental assault on the concepts, alliances, and arms control agreements that have buttressed American security for several decades, and the president's continued adherence to it constitutes one of the most reckless and irresponsible acts in the history of modern statecraft. You know, they typically measure Joe Biden, who is just engaged in the same sort of hyperbole he's engaged in now, although less cognizant of it. Not knowing anything about the underlying issue, anything about what's being said, because he is a cipher for the company. And the company is the Democrat Party. And wherever the Democrat Party is where Joe Biden is, where you will find Joe Biden. Wherever the center of gravity is, that's where you'll find him. He is a company man who recites what the company provides him to recite. Nothing more than that. As the Journal editorial board observed, the hero of last weekend was Israel's missile defense systems. The world watched in real time Saturday night as Reagan's commitment to shooting down missiles protected Israel's population from the more than 300 drones and ballistic and cruise missiles fired by Iran and its proxies at cities across Israel. And also Israel's foresight in recognizing missile defense systems sounds like a good idea, given the antagonism of some of our neighbors and the terrorist groups they sponsor. By the way, just as a quick aside, in addition to Joe the Clueless representing being present and accounted for yesterday, so was Joe the Fabulist. I mean, this is really a tortured way to try to strike at Trump with an old accusation, by the way. But old Joe had another World War II story about his family.
Back in when D-Day occurred, and on Sunday, the next day, my mother's four brothers all went down to the recruiting station and joined the military. Every one of them volunteered. And my uncle, they called him Ambrose Brosey, they called him Bosey. My uncle Bosey was a hell of an athlete, they tell me when he was a kid. And he became an Army Air Corps before the Air Force came along. He flew those single-engine planes as reconnaissance over war zones. And he got shot down in New Guinea, and they never found the body because there were a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea. And then my son volunteered to go to Iraq for a year, and he came back with stage 4 glioblastoma. And they gave, like many of you, risked your lives, and you know people who gave their lives for the country, for heroes. But one of the things that as I was doing that today, I was reminded of what my opponent said in Paris not too long ago. They asked him to go visit American grave sites. He said no, he wouldn't do it because they were all suckers and losers. I'm not making that up. The staff was listening to acknowledge it today. Suckers and losers. That man doesn't deserve it. I've been the commander chief for my son.
Yeah. That was a long way, a long walk off that short pier. Anyway.
By the way, he said it was his grandpa and not like he doesn't even know who Bosey is, Uncle Bosey, and then it was Grandpa Bosey. He told the story so many times. He can't keep his lies straight.
Yeah. I think Corn Pop was on that flight too, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
Anyway, the accusation in the direction of Trump was one made by the Washington Post back when Trump was president, and it was disputed by no less a Trump critic than his former ambassador to the UN, John Bolton, who said, you know, I was there for the conversation in question where this allegedly occurred, and I didn't hear it. But anyway, we're, you know, bringing all things back. And inventing new and exciting stories because this is what Joe Biden is left to do, is able to do. By the way, just on the story, this is nothing to denigrate the service of Uncle Bosey. But, I mean, the whole story is the way they told the story, and he may have done single engine reconnaissance planes, but it wasn't on that day. He was a passenger in a twin engine plane mm-hmm. that went down in the water, and both he and another serviceman were lost at sea,
not eaten alive.
There was one of the three that were on that flight survived, was rescued by barge, and so on and so forth. But yeah, they landed in the. I mean, it's just.
I know, and the people standing behind him while he's talking about Uncle Bosey being eaten alive by cannibals. I mean, they're like, wait, what's going? They look shocked. Like, what is he talking about?
Well,
this is
anyway.
Supposed to be a meeting about the economy.
Yeah, no, you know,
what?
But
now,
I know,
Grandpa's
I know,
getting eaten alive in the jungle.
As much of a gaffe machine and a wanderer as he is on the stump. We know from Ali Mayorkas and so many other Biden sycophants. Oh, but in private meetings, he is exacting. He is this.
He's
he is that.
Player,
sure. Well, in one of those private meetings, why don't somebody explain to him the difference between Haifa and Rafa? Anyway, we're pleased to be joined by Yenam Cohen, who is the Consul General of Israel to the Midwest. Consul General Cohen, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So what about that report that the U.S. In the Times of Israel that I mentioned at the outset, the U.S. agreed to essentially sign on to an incursion into Rafah against Hamas in exchange for more or less, to use Biden's parlance, reportedly taking the win with respect to Iran?
Engage in very intimate and strategic conversations with all our allies. The United States is the most important one, but also with our regional allies in the Middle East, because we want to find the right way to deal with the two most important dangers in our region right now. And there is Iran, the well said, launched more than 300 projectiles on Saturday night towards Israel, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones. Iran that has also nuclear capabilities and aspires to be a nuclear country. On the other hand, we have an Iranian proxy, Hamas, a terrorist organization in the Gaza Strip, who's still holding more than 130 Israeli hostages and is engaged in terrorist organizations against our country. Nation that's perpetrated the October 7th massacre, more than 1,200 Israelis. To deal with these two major challenges, threats, national security, and we do it with, you know, in partnership and with consultations with our partners, even though, of the day, it is our ultimate responsibility and obligation to take the decisions about what's the best way to defend our citizens.
I mean, I understand what your limitations are, but I mean, what can you tell us about the posture towards continuing to prosecute the campaign against Hamas, particularly since they have rejected any sort of ceasefire that would involve any immediate release of any hostages that are alive still, and also towards Iran, and whether or not now, I mean, despite Iran's reported taunting, if now isn't a good time to refocus on finishing the mission against Hamas, what additional color can you provide in terms of our better understanding that?
So in terms of Hamas, definitely the major challenge that remained in the Gaza Strip is the city of Rafah, where four Hamas battalions are still concentrated with significant military terrorist power. I've been engaged in discussions with the Americans, with the Europeans, and with our Arab neighbors about operation in Rafah, and I would say the following. What we're discussing is basically how and not the ifs, when and not the ifs, because it is very clear that we need to operate there. We need to really eliminate kind of you know, the terrorist infrastructure of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and Rafah is still a major challenge. And we also have to eliminate all the tunnels that cross the border between Rafah and Egypt, because these tunnels are used to smuggle weapons, ammunition, and the activists. So this is something that we have to take care of, and I believe that will happen. When, I cannot share any further details because I don't have them. But I do know that it should happen. It really happened. Well, Iran. Iran is a major... Sorry.
No, go ahead on Iran.
Iran is a major challenge. And I want to say one thing. Iran has been perceived as something, as a threat to Israel. Then, you know, because it is also because of its activities against some of the Arab neighbors in our region, everybody understands that Iran is a major threat, not only to Israel, but to here. They became the most partners of the Russians' aggressions against the Ukraine. What I'm trying to say is that Iran really became a global problem. That a global problem should be addressed globally. Only Israel's mission, of course, we will do whatever necessary. That all our partners, all our allies, be that. It's not only about the military reactions. One of the major things to contain Iran and to send a very strong message is, for example, by sanctions. Equivalent sanctions to send a very strong message to the Ayatollahs in Tehran that their activity against Israel in the region and against American interests be tolerated.
Well, so then how do you react to like what John Kirby and others have said, that we've been very tough on Iran, we've imposed sanctions on Iran, and then the response is, well, what about, it's not really important to argue about the number of billions of dollars that have been sent from the Obama administration and now the Biden administration, formally sent to Iran or provided to the Iranians through unfreezing of frozen assets. And Kirby's response to that, because, I mean, that number, and if you include the oil profits, I mean, it's in the hundreds of billions. But that doesn't matter. The point is, Kirby is saying, well, that's, we're monitoring these unfrozen assets and we're being tough on Iran. But what's your perspective on that? I don't know how you square that circle by providing resources and conceding, as Blinken did, that Iran uses its resources to foment terrorist activities and underwrite them.
The unprecedented attack, Iranian attack on Israel on Saturday, there is a much deeper understanding, both in the United States, but also elsewhere, in Europe and in Asia, for example, that more could be done against Iran. More could be done against Iran in terms of sanctions, in terms of freezing their assets, in terms of personal implications to the leadership of Iran. The American Congress has been engaged in that in the past days. We've seen some important legislation, and there is more on the table. The Union is getting ready to take action. Also, some Asian countries are getting ready to take action. So we might have not waited to up until now. It's better later than never. So I'm very happy that this are being taken right now.
But I mean, but you would concede it was. It's got to be Israel's position. I know it was Bibi's, that the provision of all of those monies that I referenced to Iran in terms of direct cash as well as unfreezing of assets, trading money for hostages, that was a policy that encouraged Iran to be more aggressive. That was not a policy that that brought Iran into the fold of peace in the Middle East in any way.
Contrary, they've been using to send the ammunition to send the very, very missiles to their proxies, to their terrorist organization, to their network of terrorist organizations all across the Middle East, from Hezbollah in Lebanon to the Houthis in Yemen, to the Shiite militias in Syria and Iraq, to the Islamic Jihad in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Of course, they did that. They also did that to encourage, for example, the Houthis in Yemen to threaten international commerce on the Red Sea. Indications of Iran being strong and Iran being with resources are very dangerous, again, not only to Israel, not only to the Middle East, the whole world. Very happy that there's an understanding now that a lot more should be done and could be done against Iran.
Going back to Rafah, so it's interesting you talked about Hamas having battalions and infrastructure. Because we had this conversation with an academic from Clemson University yesterday, and it's an argument that's been made by many others, too, that, look, Israel, like America couldn't kill its way out of dealing with radical Islamic terrorists. Neither can Israel kill its way, bomb its way out of Hamas. You can't eliminate Hamas because it's just you'll just enlist more people into Hamas because they've lost a family member in the war and so on and so forth. You know the argument. All you do is radicalize more by eliminating radicals. But what you're saying is, and I'm not saying that I stipulate to that because I don't, but you're saying that there is actually discernible infrastructure here that whether there are more Hamas or less Hamas, there's infrastructure that needs to be dismantled so Hamas doesn't have capacity it otherwise would, no matter what the official number of Hamas individuals, you know, individuals affiliating with Hamas turns out to be.
Absolutely, because talk about very specific numbers. Pre October 7th, Hamas, which is a terrorist organization, operates in a military-like hierarchy, has more than 40,000 combatants, terrorists, affiliated with them. We know that more than 12,000 of them are not anymore. They had 24 battalions all across the Gaza Strip. We know that 18 of them are not operative anymore because they have been eliminated by Israel. We know that they had more than 700 kilometers, that's more than 400 miles, of underground terrorist infrastructure, by the way, bigger than the subway of New York, the infrastructure in New York. And we've been eliminating a major part of these tunnels. So we have very concrete goals and we have very concrete achievements, and we know what we want to achieve. But I totally agree with you that Hamas is more than just terrorist infrastructure. Hamas is also an ideology, a very radical, hateful ideology that has been educating the children of Gaza for 20 years now, since Israel left in 2005, to hate Jews, and ultimate goal in life is to kill as many Jews as they can. Sure about the radicalization because of this military operation. They have been radicalized for 20 years, and I think that the second stage after the military operation should really be long process of uprooting the ideology of Gaza Strip, the hateful, murderous ideology of Hamas. And I'm always thinking of the Americans, because this is exactly what you did in Nazi Germany after World War II, right? A very long process of denazification, uprooting the Nazi ideology of the brains and minds of German people. And as much as the Americanification process was successful, I believe that we can do the same in the Gaza Strip. To believe in what we do.
He is Yenam Cohen. He is the Consul General of Israel to the Midwest. Consul General Cohen, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Uri Berliner, the NPR business news senior editor, who was suspended without pay after detailing NPR's leftist activism masquerading as journalism, distinguishing it from the NPR from a bygone era when he started. He was there 25 years. That was, yes, left, and the audience was majority left, and the staff was majority left, but it would still do news and news programming, and you'd hear the other side. You wouldn't be completely in the tank for your side.
No, but this is, I mean, basically, he said their mission was to destroy President Trump.
We were trying to damage his presidency, to even find anything we could to harm him. And I think what we latched on to was Russia collusion. It was just rumors, and a lot of it based on pretty shoddy documents or evidence. We really latched on to Adam Schiff. He was like our muse to the Trump collusion story. And then the Mueller report came out, and no collusion. And, you know, I think we sort of learned to sort of the story kind of disappeared.
Yeah, it disappeared, but without an accounting for all the misreporting, yep, which is key. And he used the Hunter Biden laptop story as another example, a story they dutifully ignored in advance of 2020 because they understood that that was in service of their political interests in helping Biden get elected. And then once you have ceded all sorts of it, all semblance of integrity, and you're just going to be completely in service to a particular political party and those who share your ideology, well, then you might as well just scorch the earth and eliminate all dissent. And that's what they've done, as many other outlets have, too. This one, of course, taxpayer funded. Well, Berliner was suspended without pay for his candor, part of which you just heard there in an interview he did with Barry Weiss at the Free Press. Mm-hmm. And yesterday he announced he's resigning. I'm resigning from NPR, a great American institution where I've worked for 25 years. I respect the integrity of my colleagues and wish for NPR to thrive and do important journalism. However, he said, quote, he cannot work in a newsroom where I am disparaged by a new CEO whose divisive views confirm the very problems at NPR I cite in my Free Press essay. Right. So to the extent you were going to have any independent, and Berliner is a man of the left, as he readily concedes, but to the extent you're going to have any independent thinkers or men and women of the left who do want to do journalism and do want to present information as fairly as possible, respect their consumers enough, readers and listeners enough to present what they understand to be the dynamics of a particular person or story or a contest and let people make their own decisions, well, that has to be rooted out as well, and it's going to be. And Catherine Maher is just the person to do it. As we talked about the other day, many of her tweets so indicate. But so too does her past professional life. Before taking the post as CEO of NPR, Catherine Maher was the CEO of Wikipedia.
She did a TED Talk.
Well, before we get to that, at Wikipedia, you know, these were heady times and difficult times. You had a novel coronavirus, you know, the pandemic. What did Wikipedia do, one wonders, to root out misinformation and disinformation, to suppress dangerous thinking and expressions of said thinking on Wikipedia? Catherine Maher, in an interview she gave in 21 with the Atlantic Council, connecting dots here, the Atlantic Council, you recall, one of the organizations, it's state-funded too, like NPR, one of the organizations in that election partnership consortium at Stanford University that Michael Benz has talked about and that we know a lot more about now, that was instrumental in serving as a cutout for the federal government to suppress disinformation, misinformation, in other words, viewpoints that they do not share. This is part of the Twitter Files reporting. So these are people on the same side representing different organizations attempting to accomplish the same political ends. And listen very closely to Catherine Maher back in 21.
We took a very active approach to disinformation and misinformation coming into not just the last election, but also looking at how we supported our editing community in an unprecedented moment where we were not only dealing with the global pandemic, we were dealing with a novel virus, which by definition means we knew nothing about it in real time, and we're trying to figure it out as the pandemic went along. And so we really set up in response to both the pandemic, but also in response to the upcoming U.S. election and as a model for future elections outside of the U.S., including a number that are happening this year, was we just obviously went through yet another Israeli election. The model was around how do we create sort of a clearinghouse of information that brings the institution of the Wikimedia Foundation with the editing community in order to be able to identify threats early on through conversations with government, of course, as well as other platform operators to understand sort of what the landscape looks like.
Through conversations with government, of course. Through conversations with government, of course. That's how we're going to play our role in suppressing viewpoints with which we disagree. And that's what they did. That's what she did, CEO of Wikipedia. And by the way, it's interesting because Larry Sanger, who's the co-founder of Wikipedia, along with Jimmy Wales, wrote a piece over at his Substack or his website, LarrySanger.org, back in June of 21, talking about how Wikipedia, and this would have been during Catherine Maher's tenure, has completely abandoned its neutrality principle, which was one of the main sort of principles of how they were going to do writing, encyclopedia writing. Sanger goes through this in some detail. It's very good. A neutrality, not being objectivity. Neutrality meaning objectivity is sort of a fiction. I'm objective, you're subjective. Everybody's subjective. Neutrality is the goal here. You present both sides of the argument in a way that reflects the reality of their positions, and then people make up their minds. And if you are going to reference somebody's work, Claudine Gay, then you cite it. And if you have a claim you're making with particular numbers, then you cite it, so forth. You cite the sourcing, basic stuff. Neutrality, though, was key. Neutrality was gone. And Sanger, in this piece that he wrote back in June of 21, goes through four case studies, sort of the way that Uri Berliner did in terms of what's happened at NPR. The four case studies were the Trump impeachments, the Biden scandals, the Antifa and BLM riots, and the alleged election irregularities. And it provides really great detail in terms of what the original vision was when Sanger and Wales founded Wikipedia at the first part of the century. I think it was 01. And what it's become under the previous leadership of people like Catherine Maher.
Have you ever checked your Wikipedia page to see if it's accurate?
I haven't checked in a while. Yeah, maybe I will now.
It's weird. Yeah. People must add things to it because I don't know where they got some information on certain things.
Well, yeah. I mean, there is some reputation management that's required online if you care so much about your reputation. But as John Wooden said, your reputation is just what other people think of you. I don't spend a lot of time worrying about that. But anyway.
As Mary Tyler Moore said, what other people think of me is none of my business.
Right. There you go. Catherine Maher also gave a TED Talk that you were referencing, Amy, in which she provided a little bit more insight into her philosophy. You know, I mean, NPR is still a big deal.
Oh, yeah. Well, so we're being bored.
Exactly. That alone.
Big Bird.
I'm sure.
Cookie Monster. Yes.
Uh-huh. Cookie Monster, who Biden's go-to guy on taxes?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. No, on shrinkflation. Shrinkflation, yeah. Yeah, the Cookie Monster is his shrinkflation jar.
Well, because the
that's
cookie's
right.
not as big as it used to be when you buy the cookie, because it's cookie. Shrunk.
Cookie. Yeah.
So, Catherine, this is sort of important. I mean, you know, and also it's important to understand how these institutions become so corrupted and maybe share this information with your friends who still are, you know, just look at, it's like looking at your alma mater. Oh, this school, back when I went there, this was a great school. Well, have you paid attention to what's happened to it in the intervening couple decades, generations, or however long? Have you paid attention to what NPR has become today versus what it was when Steve Edwards was doing 848 in Chicago, or you were enjoying All Things Considered, or what have you? Pay attention to what it is now. Take a listen. Take a read through. Take a walk through if it's a school. You know, institutions change. They get corrupted. Have you noticed? Catherine Maher on Truth. Oh, boy.
But what about the hard things, the places where we are prone to disagreement, say politics and religion? Well, as it turns out, not only does Wikipedia's model work there, it actually works really well. Because in our normal lives, these contentious conversations tend to erupt over disagreement about what the truth actually is. But the people who write these articles, they're not focused on the truth. They're focused on something else, which is the best of what we can know right now. And after 7 years of working with these brilliant folks, I've come to believe that they are onto something, that perhaps for our most tricky disagreements, seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth might not be the right place to start. In fact, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground and getting things done. Now, that is not to say that the truth doesn't exist, nor is it to say that the truth isn't important. Clearly, the search for the truth has led us to do great things, to learn great things. But I think if I were to really ask you to think about this, one of the things that we could all acknowledge is that part of the reason we have such glorious chronicles to the human experience and all forms of culture is because we acknowledge there are many different truths. And so in the spirit of that, I'm certain that the truth exists for you and probably for the person sitting next to you. But this may not be the same truth. This is because the truth of the matter is very often, for many people, what happens when we merge facts about the world with our beliefs about the world. So we all have different truths. They're based on things like where we come from, how we were raised, and how other people perceive us.
That's identitarian scripture right there.
That's why you don't do TED Talks. Oh, my God. Would you ever have a friend like that who talks like this to you? And how are you? How was your day? And then let me tell you what I think.
She's so reasonable and inclusive and thoughtful. This is my thoughtful voice. I've thought through these things. Now please listen and follow along. That's just a great case study in sentimental barbarism. Yeah, everybody is their own God. I got it. Everybody has their own truth. This is my truth redux, which is nothing new because she's not a novel thinker. She's a basically an apparatchik for this new Marxism that comes in the form of identitarianism. But for people who don't respect that everybody has their own truth, well, we got to silence them. Can't hear their truth. Right. I mean, that what you just heard there is the secular humanist philosophy of the totalitarian. And that's clearly what Catherine Maher is. Just ask Yuri Berliner, her leftist buddy. By the way, it's also something, too. Oh, Yuri Berliner, people speaking out, that's going to change the institution. I don't think you appreciate how far these institutions are gone, how far places like NPR are gone. I mean, Yuri Berliner, he must have known he had no chance of surviving there after he did what he did. And, I mean, he did the public a service, as I said, right from the outset. But I'm sure he knew that he would be walking away from NPR in the not too distant future unless there was some sort of epiphany that occurred. Well, he knew, and there are no epiphanies that are coming. Sarah in Glenview, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I'd like the conservative analog to Wikipedia. I would call it Wackopedia. If Wikipedia is determining people's reputations, we would have confront them with something like what Trump did. He created Truth Social. What Elon Musk did, he converted he converted it to X. We need to
Elon
change.
Musk, yeah, Twitter to X, yes.
Right. We need to get ahead of this and do what they're doing and determine people's reputations right up front.
Thanks for the call, Sarah. Frank, Board of Trade.
Yeah, in 2008, I was living in Denver, and every morning I would listen to NPR on the way in. Every morning there would be sirens blaring from Kabul, the day after the election, 2008, November 5, the sirens stopped.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I got it. Thanks for the call, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.